Okay, thank you everybody for coming out to the Library and Educator Day at the Toronto Comic Art Festival. There's a whole lot of seats up front, so don't be shy. Please feel free to come on down and join us. I'm Charles Brownstein. I'm the Executive Director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and this morning I'm going to be speaking to you about intellectual freedom and comic censorship. But before we begin, I would like to take a moment to acknowledge that the Toronto Comic Art Festival is a volunteer-driven event that is put together by some really great folks here in Toronto, in the comics community, in the library community, in the education community, and they work really hard all year making this happen. So I'd just like to take a quick moment to acknowledge them all with a round of our applause and thanks. Down front, you see that we have some takeaway materials of recent information from Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, so please come on down and grab those. But for now, let's begin our main talk about banned comics. So you hear the word banned comics, and it brings up all kinds of lurid associations with the past of comics history. This idea that promulgated in the mid-century of the mid-20th century, that comics were this lowbrow, deviant, or in other ways unwelcoming medium, this medium that was harmful for young minds. And there was a stigma that developed in the mid-century around this notion that comics bred juvenile delinquency, that comics were a medium that would discourage minors from reading, that would just somehow turn good kids into bad kids. And those media effects arguments, which were promulgated in the United States by Dr. Frederick Wortham in his book, The Seduction of the Innocent, infected the view of comics in the United States, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, wherever the English language was being used within comics. And so it led to a period of time in the 1950s where there were actually laws passed here in Canada. There were actually laws passed in the United States and in the United Kingdom that prohibited the sale or display of certain comics. And the backwash of that is that there was this idea that comics as a whole were only appropriate for either the very youngest of readers, which is what comics really became after the scare in the 1950s, or the very dimmest of readers. So if you were reading comics as a teenager, as an adult, there was something wrong with you. You were up to no good. You were, as they say, touched in a fashion. And so this led to a idea that comics were banned and bannable. Now, over the years, of course, the fact that we're all here at the Toronto Comics Arts Festival and we see that comics are really central in the cultural conversation, it leads to a topic like the one we have today for people to scratch their heads and say, wait a minute, you mean they still ban comics? I thought that that all went away. Or perhaps if you only came to comics over the last 5 or 10 years, and you're really lucky if you did because you have so much great content to discover, you don't know that comics are ever controversial or banned at all. But in fact, yes, there is still a large tendency for individual people to try to take away readers' power to determine what is right for them. Or there are still individuals that determine that their view of parenting is the right view of parenting for everybody. And so you have frequently, whether it's here in Canada, whether it's where I'm based in the United States, for individuals to object on a content level to a work of art, a work of film, or a work of comics, and say, I don't want this in my home, it shouldn't be in the library. Naturally, if you don't want this in your home, that's your right as a parent, but you can't take that choice away from other people. And a lot of those tendencies, whether it's I'm offended by this for the general population, or I'm offended by this, kids shouldn't see it, you've got that right to make the decision for yourself as an individual, but not for others. And when people do attempt to make that choice for other people, that's where this idea of banning comes in. There are no reliable statistics involving how many comics or books are banned, but there are organizations that do the work of tracking that. Here in Canada, you've got freedomtoread.ca that do wonderful work creating surveys each year about how books and other library resources are challenged or banned. And every year they publish their resource list. In recent years, it's hovered in the range of just about under 100 challenges per year. In the United States, we have the American Library Association, and they each year create a report that estimates how many books are banned or challenged in libraries. And in the 2014 period, the report indicates that at least 311 books and probably many more were challenged in schools and libraries. And the reason that we say probably many more is because the vast majority of challenges or bans to material do go unreported, either because the individuals are, in the average case scenario, afraid of some kind of administrative repercussion, afraid of losing their job, or because there's a view that, sure, you and I as community members can make a decision that this thing that was selected, we can just quietly put it over there without the process. And so a lot of times these reports don't happen. And so we have just this tip of iceberg number of about 100 per year challenged in Canada, somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 to 400 a year challenged in the United States. So what is a book ban? Well, there's actually a path to censorship that the ALA has created here that leads us to the notion of a ban. The first thing is the challenge, the expression of concern. And generally speaking, this applies as an inquiry that has judgmental overtones. And that's fine. Libraries are public places, and nobody can dictate that people shouldn't be judgmental about the things that genuinely offend them. But what you often see, for instance, I'll use an example from the freedomtoread.ca papers. A parent wanted to have graphic novels struck from their library in British Columbia because they have the Star Wars manga series. And in that manga series, Princess Leia is depicted wearing a low-cut top that she would frequently threaten to fall out of but didn't. And so it was, don't you think this is far too risque for our library? That's the expression of concern with the judgmental overtones. Completely valid, but that is generally the first step. The second step is the oral complaint. If at first the library person says, well, you know, sure, we understand that that's your point of view. We think that it has value on the shelf for X, Y, and Z reasons. If that person disagrees, they can then say, well, no, I don't think that this is appropriate in here, and I think that you should remove it. That's the oral complaint. Where the formal process of challenges happen, and I don't really know the full process here in Canada, but I can say in the United States, and I suspect it's similar here, there is a process by which material can be removed, and that usually begins with writing. The formal written complaint filed with the institution that challenges the presence or appropriateness of the specific material. And that should signal a push towards policy where there will be hearings determining the outcome of whether this book can be kept within the library or the school system. Adjacent to this, and I think a much more severe thing that happens, is this idea of the public attack, this publicly disseminated statement that challenges the value of the material. And oftentimes, this is presented in a fashion where people go to the media sometimes before they actually make the complaint within the library environment. We're going to talk in a few moments about an instance happening in the United States where a parent went to the local news media about a very popular and well-regarded literary graphic novel and said, this is child pornography. And the news media picked this up because that makes for good headlines, doing great disservice to the community. So the public attack happens in ways that I'll show you in a little bit. And finally, there's censorship, the change in the access status of material based on the content of the work. And this could be a variety of things, such as, in the worst case, exclusion or removal from the library system, or sometimes it takes the form of age or grade level changes, or certain notes. Like the way the Star Wars thing resolved is they put red stickers on those books saying that this might raise a flag that you should be aware of. I don't really make judgments about things like that, but they are, technically speaking, censorship activities. So why are comics banned? For a lot of the same reasons that books are banned. Generally speaking, people will respond to certain content in a fashion that looks at the world from their own point of view. And I want to really emphasize here that most of the time, the people that are challenging content are well-meaning people. There really aren't too many folks that wake up in the morning and say, ha-ha, I'm going to remove all of the joy from life and take away the comic books. That doesn't happen too frequently, although I have met those people. Generally speaking, though, these are well-meaning people that go, this particular thing offends my value system, and as a member of the community, this doesn't reflect me, and so I'm going to attempt to remove this. And so you will see frequent complaints for things like adult content, inappropriate language, violence or horror, sexuality or nudity, or because something is age inappropriate, where this is heightened for comics, if you were at the Scott McCloud lecture just an hour ago, is that, as he said, comics thrive on the power of the static image. And so unlike a visual medium like film or television, where the flow of story is time, comics don't have that. In a movie, if you want to complain about the subject matter, you have to take the work as a whole, or you have to freeze frame that scene and look kind of creepy for freeze framing that scene. In a book of prose, you're really only, it's really only as filthy as the imagination of the viewer. And again, you have to decode the meaning from the work in a fashion that requires the work to be engaged with on a level because it's such an abstract way of communicating. Comics, on the other hand, thrive on the power of the static image in a fashion that enables the material to be open to a page and for somebody to linger on the individual panel and to take that panel on its own outside of the context and then challenge the material from a viewpoint perspective. At least once a year, I'll get a call from somebody saying, why is there a book in my library with a giant naked blue guy walking around? How is that a thing that is allowed to happen? And I'll have to explain that book is Watchmen, and it's a very important, you know. But again, the individual image allows it to be taken out of context to enable the challenge, to enable the ban. And then the other thing that happens is what I had mentioned before, the history of comics as low-value speech enters into it. Comics aren't real books. Comics are something that people of low regard turn to. Comics are something that are for dessert, but it's not real literature, and it shouldn't be on the same shelf with the real literature. All of these things contribute to the notions of why comics are banned. And so, you know, just once again, some really basic notions as to why bans happen. Profanity, offensive language, sex or nudity, violence or horror, drugs or alcohol, politically, socially, or racist or offensive material, offensive to religious beliefs. All of these things enter into the big picture of why people will challenge material. And this leads us to the essential question of whether the viewpoints of the few should dictate what the rest of the library's patrons or their children may read. And to the point of view of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, our bias is that the rights, that the individual or the individual parent is the best judge of their own intellectual development. If you don't like something, don't look at it. But don't deprive the rest of the community from the opportunity to make that decision for themselves. Don't deprive other parents of the teaching opportunity that a book creates. Don't deprive young people of the opportunity to see themselves reflected in fiction in a fashion that allows them to engage with the things that are happening in their life. Art creates a safe space where people can engage with the world on terms that are very personal and can engage with the world on terms that allow them to grapple with ideas in ways that other things can't. It's the job we charge our artists with doing. It's the job that our readers do when they turn to art. And I can't imagine anything more horrible than being a child or a younger teenager and being told that this material that you identify with should be banned, because that is saying to a certain degree that you should be banned, that something that you value is somehow wrong or incorrect. And so now we get to the good part, right? Everybody wants to know, so what things are banned anyway? What are we talking about? And so I'll start with the 2014 list of the most frequently banned and challenged books, according to the American Library Association. This is what happened in the States last year. Number two book on that list, and we'll talk about it in detail in a couple of moments, was Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi. And the reasons that were identified in the official challenges here were gambling, offensive language, political viewpoint, politically, racially, or socially offensive, and the use of graphic depictions. And Persepolis has been challenged repeatedly in schools and libraries all over the States for reasons that I think will surprise you. The sixth most challenged book in 2014 was the book Saga by Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples. Saga is a science fiction book cut from the Samuel R. Delaney School of Science Fiction that is about this young family that come from opposite sides of a interstellar war who decide that they are going to break free from the war and break free from their military obligations and find love with each other and produce a child through that union that is found to be unholy by the rest of the galaxy. And so it's ironic that this book, which is all about family achieving against great odds, is regarded as anti-family in the reasons for many of its challenges. It's also frequently challenged because it contains nudity, offensive language, is sexually explicit, and is, quote, unsuited for age group. Now, Saga is not marketed as anything but a book that is designed for adult readers, and so here you also enter into a lot of the misconceptions that comics are strictly a juvenile medium, when in fact there are comics for every reader, but not every comic is for all readers. Finally, the 10th book on this list is Drama by Raina Telgemeier, which is a book for middle grade readers about a middle school drama production that contains a character that is coming to terms with the fact that this character is homosexual. It's very interesting that the challenge here, and there are a preponderance of challenges. That's why it's number 10 on the most commonly challenged. The only reason listed is sexually explicit. And so in some communities, the mere mention of homosexuality is what leads people to the idea that it is sexually explicit. And so everybody's entitled to their viewpoint, and these viewpoints, however, do lead to the attempt to restrict content in ways that, as information professionals, we have to take seriously and engage with, but also need to stand up for the rights of all of our patrons to indicate that while this may not be something you value, it does have value for the community. Here in Canada, I'll take questions at the end.
I was just going to ask, I apologize, I was a little bit slow getting here. The hyperlinks, different colors suggest this is hyperlinked. Is this shared somewhere that
nope.
I can put to my library blog? Or
no, it's not.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so, but I will take questions at the end. The challenges in Canada, if you look at freedomtoread.ca, which is a great resource website, these are books sampled over the last 4 years. Love and Rockets, according to a 2011 Canada censorship survey, was the impetus to challenge the entire graphic novel category in an Ontario library. So there was this view of a patron who had not checked in with comics for some time that the presence of this book that addresses adult themes is enough to get rid of the entire category. The Star Wars manga series that I mentioned was a challenged book. Nagima, the manga series. Young Lions, the graphic novel by Blaise Lormé, was challenged at Canada Customs, where Canada Customs frequently will attempt to block content in ways that often has criminal repercussions that the fund has been engaged with. The Walking Dead, Tintin in the Congo, Hellboy Jr., Sophie Crumb, Evolution of a Crazy Artist, Tales from the Farm from the Essex County trilogy by Jeff Lemire, Iron Man Extremis, The New Adventures of Jesus by Frank Stack, which is a really seminal underground comic, that really one of the things that kicked off that movement, War Stories Volume 1 by Garth Ennis, Breakdowns by Art Spiegelman, Black Hole by Charles Burns, The Boys Volume 5, Herogasm by Garth Ennis and Derek Robertson, which was actually removed from the library because it had no redeeming value, was the reason. Catwoman Crime Pays, an anthology of graphic fiction, cartoons, and true stories by Ivan Brunetti. And that's just from their spreadsheets from the last 3-4 years that you can find on freedomtoread.ca. Now, what those lists in the States and in Canada tell us is that there's a wide variety of material that is challenged. Now, fortunately, a lot of times through dialogue, through having good policies in place, through engaging with your community, those challenges are able to be resolved amicably and the material is able to be retained, but that doesn't always happen. For now, I'd like to talk about some challenges that are happening this quarter that the fund is actively engaged with defending. The book This One Summer by Mariko and Jillian Tamaki was the recently received the Caldecott Honor in the United States, which is the highest honor for a picture book. And that honor has, for the most part, been going to books on the younger side of the Caldecott spectrum. It goes from very young to about age 14. This book is a book for middle grade readers that addresses adolescence, that addresses the lives of these two pubescent girls that are on their family vacation, and they've gone to the same shore every year for many years now, and now they are on the cusp of 13. And it's about their perceptions of how life is changing around them. And so it shows how the older kids are speaking as older kids do down at the local convenience store and using profanity and talking about sex and talking about pregnancy. There's a thread in the book that talks about miscarriage. These are all things that young adults have to grapple with. And what This One Summer does so eloquently is it speaks on the same level as those kids in a way that allows them to engage with the material. Now, unfortunately, a lot of the challenges are coming from people that are just not ready to have that conversation in their households, which I wouldn't want to be a parent right now. It's a difficult world out there. But art exists to help mediate those things. Art exists to help create a safe space to engage in that conversation. And so since the Caldecott, the fund has been involved in a variety of challenges to this book, actually counseling teachers and librarians with resources that can be used to help keep this in the library. And if you go to cbldf.org, where most of the links that the lady was asking about and most of this information is discussed in greater detail. Palomar by Gilbert Hernandez. Gilbert is the other brother in the Love and Rockets canon. And where Love and Rockets was the basis for a challenge here in Canada that attempted to remove all graphic novels because of this series, particularly the work by Jaime, the other brother in this. In New Mexico, there's a battle that was raging throughout the spring in Rancho High School in New Mexico, where a student at this high school brought home the book, which is a 500-page tome that tells the story of this fictional South American community of Palomar. And it is deeply ensconced within the canon of Latin American literature. And so it deals with issues of cultural identity, memory, sexuality, dreams. It's written for adult audiences, but it has pedagogical value for teenage audiences. And that's why this book was selected for the library back in 2006. This was the first time the book was challenged, when it was checked out by a student at the system, and the parent looked at the material and objected to some of the nudity in there and objected to some of the language in there. Again, completely her right, but she went immediately to the news media and said, this material is child pornography, and this is in the library where anybody can see it, and this shouldn't be there. This is like having Hustler in the library. And so a news station, KOAT, unquestionably picked up the book and created a really biased story around it. They showed the mother's copy that was still checked out of the system, which was flagged with the post-it notes of every page that she found dirty, and they said, this book is so objectionable, we can't show it on TV, but we can show you all these post-it notes with what we can't show you on TV. But they didn't engage the other side of all of the awards this has won, of the fact that this book is regarded as a real touch point in creating a literature of Mexican-American identity within the United States, which is something that certainly matters to the community in New Mexico. The fund jumped on this story and worked with our colleagues at the Kids Right to Read Project to speak up in the book's defense that it wasn't pornographic. It certainly wasn't child pornography, which is photographic evidence of a crime, and that should be prosecuted to the fullest extent. In fact, this book has no depictions of young people engaged in any sexual behavior whatsoever. We wrote a letter of support of the book to the school's board, who ultimately determined by a vote of 5-3 on March 16th to retain the book. So the book stays. You think, wonderful, victory. Well, the mother goes immediately to the news media and says, I'm not giving up because this book teaches children how to engage in child pornography and it teaches children how to engage in prostitution. Well, no, it doesn't. I don't know what book you read, but now you're also changing your story because you didn't get the outcome you wanted. You don't respect your community enough to uphold their decision. If you don't want it in your house, absolutely, that's your right. But you're depriving the other parents in the community, and you're also saying that your judgment is better than the judgment of the professionals that have made this decision. So she's vowed to appeal this to the district, and we are, you know, currently monitoring the situation to see if that hearing is going to occur and stand ready to continue to defend the book. But this gives you a really clear example of how the challenge on the public basis happens and how dangerous that is, because accusing somebody of promulgating child pornography is one of the most offensive accusations, because it's an accusation that sticks with somebody forever, and in this case completely groundless, unnecessarily damaging, demeaning. But this is a risk that librarians find themselves in, which is again why you don't see challenges reported very frequently, because the consequences may not be legal. It may not be that you would lose your job, although that is a consequence people worry about. It might just be you're standing a reputation in the community. But it's important to create a body of knowledge and a body of understanding about comics so that we can intelligently respond to these challenges, so that books don't get removed, so that people continue to have access to these important ideas. The last challenge that we've been involved with this quarter is The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman and P. Craig Russell. And this is an adaptation of the Newbery Honor winning book, The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman, that was adapted into a graphic novel. It was challenged in a school that got in touch with us because there was depiction of a murder in the first few pages of the book that are critical to setting up what happens afterwards. And thanks in part to our efforts, the review committee voted to keep the book on library shelves. So now let's go back historically to some examples of what's challenged. Would you believe Bone by Jeff Smith is one of the most frequently banned and challenged books? In fact, in 2013, it occupied the spot that this year is occupied by Drama as the 10th most banned book of the year. Now, a typical challenge of this book that the fund was actively involved with happened in April of 2010 in Minnesota, where a parent whose son had just completed the local anti-drug and alcohol program called DARE discovered images in book 4, The Dragon Slayer, where the characters Phony Bone, who's kind of this greedy little sneak of a character, and Lucius Down, the local tavern owner, have a beer selling competition to see who can sell the most beer, which has some repercussions on the overall story, and it's very funny and it's presented as humor. And at the same time, the character Smiley Bone, his cousin, who's kind of the kind of like goofy in this situation, is always smoking a cigar. And the parents said, well, how is it that our kids just completed this anti-drug and alcohol program, but they can read this book where the character's smoking and character's drinking beer? Because I guess adults don't do that in Minnesota? I don't know. And, of course, the complaint, completely valid if you want to make it, but the committee listened to it and said, well, we respect that that's your opinion, but this book has value and was retained. But Bone has been banned and challenged elsewhere. The Texas Civil Liberties Union does a really great job tracking challenges each year and has found that the book has been challenged for unhealthful sexual scenes, because there's a image in book 1 of Phone Bone and Thorn, who's this female character that he has a crush on, going to bathe where nothing is shown. But the mere idea that this little cartoon character would be bathing with this young girl character was enough to send somebody to believe this is going to put bad ideas in a kid's head. There's also somebody challenged the book on political viewpoint, which it's about the restoration of a magical kingdom, so maybe there was an anti-monarchist in the room, I don't know. But all of these things are out there as reasons that this book has been challenged, but it happens quite frequently. So Bone is a frequent example. But what's also disturbing is seeing that challenges are not just limited to the realm of fantasy, but they're also moving into the realm of memoir, and they're moving into the realm of books for adult readers. And so Fun Home by Alison Bechdel has been a weather vane for challenges over recent years. Back in 2010, it was the subject of a challenge in a library in Minnesota alongside the book Blankets by Craig Thompson, where the person challenging alleged that these books were pornography, and Fun Home in particular, because it addresses homosexuality as gay porn. And so the people that go to the truck stop sex store are going to start coming to our libraries because these books are in there. I'm not making that up. I'm not that creative. This challenge happened and ultimately was overcome. But more recently and more seriously in the state of South Carolina in the United States, the book faced a challenge where it was the subject of a freshman reads event at the College of Charleston in South Carolina, where freshman students are all given a book to read if they so choose. And that year the book was Fun Home. And they have events where the author is brought in and a conversation is had around the school around this one book. And Fun Home, addressing issues of family, sexuality, and tolerance, seemed to be a perfectly useful book to assign to these adults in institution of higher learning as a voluntary assignment. A local family values group objected to the book, saying that it was promoting a homosexual agenda and using public money to do so, and that the school should be shamed for using this and should not be allowed to spend this public money to bring in its author to promote this homosexual agenda. And the school said, thank you for your opinion. We disagree with you, but that's what's great about the First Amendment. You've got the right to free speech. We've got the right to teach. And we're going to go about our business. They did. But the following January, state legislators in South Carolina attempted to defund the College of Charleston by $52,000, which is the exact amount needed for the annual College Reads program. And so this battle raged for several months, and organizations including the CBLDF, the Kids' Right to Read Project, the ALA, voiced their concern with this unconstitutional use of the budget process to defund the university for engaging in legitimate pedagogical work. And ultimately, a so-called compromise was arrived at that said that instead of cutting the funds, the legislature would issue a budget that allows those same funds to be reallocated to teach books about the Constitution, which ironically, when they're teaching those books about the Constitution, the kids should be able to intuit was an unconstitutional imposition on the rights of academia. And so Fun Home is a book that continually receives challenges and is still controversial. We have case studies and teaching guides for all of these books at cbldf.org, so if in your process of selecting them for your school or your library, you have some resources that can help you defend that and also engage with your patrons about that conversation. The most shocking instance of book censorship recently has been the controversies around Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi. This is a memoir of growing up during the Iranian Revolution about Satrapi as a young girl growing up in an environment where the world was changing around her, that is particularly relevant in this era where we struggle with issues of multiculturalism and identity and understanding the world around us. And this creates a very personal view of what policy decisions executed on the government levels do to the people beneath them. And it's a useful tool for teaching how the world behaves. And so while the book was controversial in the Middle East for presenting this view, there were no publicly reported challenges or bans of the book in the U.S. until March of 2013, when Chicago Public Schools administrators abruptly pulled it from some classrooms. And there's a researcher named Jarrett Dapier, who's a graduate student in Chicago, that recently did research that uncovered a conspiracy in the Chicago schools to basically ban this book, and then they went back and covered up the attempt to ban it. Because the way everything unfolded is that a memorandum went out late at night on a Wednesday that was then put up on Reddit, which was, hey, is this for real? This memo that says, take this book out of the schools and out of the classrooms. And within 24 hours, the students at Lane Tech High School, which was the first school where the book was in contention, actually hosted a sit-in where they demonstrated publicly that you can't take this book away from us. And so that raised the profile of this challenge to national prominence, calling attention to the issue, and ultimately allowing the book to be retained for some, but not all, students within the Lane Tech environment. Since then, there have been subsequent challenges to Persepolis in Illinois and in Oregon in the United States for a lot of the same viewpoint-oriented reasons. And it would take an entire hour to talk about the saga of just sheer bizarre, pardon the expression, fuckery that went down to make this occur. And I choose that word not lightly, because when you read everything that happened, it's really mind-boggling how policy was rejected in favor of what was ultimately a witch hunt about getting rid of a particular book. These things do still happen, and I encourage you to look at cdldf.org to get a better view of them. You can also read the first issue of our magazine, The Defender, which is a quarterly news magazine that some of you were able to pick up. I didn't have enough copies for everybody, which talks about other recent challenges. That includes a proposal in the United States to red flag books according to arbitrary standards that would require parents to give express permission for children to read a book that was assigned that has an area of concern. There are challenges all the times to books like Sherman Alexie's The True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. There are books challenges all the time to some of the perks of being a wallflower, other books the fund is involved in. There's a great deal of scrutiny and challenge on the idea that books should be rated or that parents should be alerted that material might be sexually explicit, that is framed in a fashion that makes a chilling effect upon educators that are using legitimate materials that have and have been used as pedagogically sound over the years to then, based on a single aspect of the whole, have to defend the book as a whole in ways that are new and problematic in the teaching of these books and in schools. And I encourage you to look at cdldf.org for more of that. So we've talked about all of these challenges. We've talked about all of these specific cases because they show the whole of how censorship happens. Censorship is not limited to a single point of view. It's not just, I object to Saga because it's got nudity and sexuality in it. That shouldn't be in the library. It's also books like Bone. I object to this book because it depicts people drinking or it's anti-authoritarian. It's an entire spectrum of content. Challenges can come from anywhere. And so it's important to be equipped to address these challenges empathetically, but professionally and firmly as well. And the most important way to do that is, first of all, have strong policies. Your best friend, as a librarian, as a teacher, is to have policies that are written down that show how materials are selected, and how materials are considered, and how challenges are managed in your system. And then, of course, to actually follow those policies when these things happen. One of the most important things, whether it's challenges to a book, whether it's setting up a contest, whether it's setting up a curriculum, is that if you set up the rules and you're transparent about them in a way that reasonable adults can see are reasonable, then the unreasonable adult can throw all the stones that he or she wants to. If we all agree the rules are reasonable and they're right there, that shields you against 90% of the challenges that happen. Number two, consult the experts, because you don't need to do this in the dark and you don't need to reinvent the wheel. There are groups, whether it's freedomtoread.ca, whether it's ALA.org, the American Library Association, whether it's my group, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, that have tools available to help you when books are challenged. And so don't go it alone. There are experts that are there to help you. And in fact, in the cases that I called out by name, the fund was directly involved on the phone with the concerned individuals, providing them with the tools they needed to reach out. So there are experts that are there to help you. and also report the challenge. It might seem a minor thing that a book was objected to in your system and you were able to resolve it amicably at the oral concern stage by saying, yes, I understand that you object to this book about a giant naked blue dude, but it's actually not about that. It's an allegory about the politics that we still deal with today, and it's won all of these awards, and it definitely is appropriately shelved in the adult section of our library, so we appreciate the concern, and the person walks away and says, yeah, okay, I guess that's reasonable, which is the way the bulk of these things actually go down, thank goodness. And that stuff's not reported. By reporting it, though, it creates a body of knowledge and awareness for your peers in the information professions to know, well, what are the books people are paying attention to right now? What are the reasons that these books are being objected to? And by gathering that data, groups like the Fund, groups like freedomtoread.ca, groups like ALA, are able to then create better resources to help the entire community cope with these matters. In managing challenges, once you've got those tools, once you've reported the challenge, once you've got the policy in mind, once you've used the policy documents that the ALA provides to help you craft one, then the day of truth comes. The person walks up to you with the objection. The important thing, keep it simple and respect their humanity, because a lot of times the person that's raising a challenge just wants to be heard. A lot of censorship is really about control. And we live in times where increasingly it's hard to feel that we do have control over our lives. We're dealing with complicated economic times. I've noticed that a lot of instances of censorship go up in times of economic uncertainty. We're dealing with times when kids have access to incredibly powerful computers, the likes of which were not possible a generation ago, right in their pocket. And everybody knows that they have access to an entire world of information and conversations that they might be ready to access and talk about, but that parents may not be ready to engage with them on. And I don't want to be a parent right now because nobody over the age of 25 has any idea what it's like to be under 25. It's a completely different world right now. But oftentimes the challenges will happen because I may not be able to control what they're looking at on their browser, on their phone, because they're smarter about using it than I am. But I can control them reading this book about this drama club where there's a gay kid in there. And I can say, I don't want that book in the system. And so a lot of times, the person that's bringing the challenge has something else going on, and they just want to be heard. And oftentimes, being respectful, engaging with them, person to person, allowing them to express their point of view is all that's needed for them to go, you know what, thank you for hearing me, there was something else happening in this instance. When that doesn't happen, when it is a person like the lady in New Mexico that unreasonably believes that Love and Rockets is a manual for perversion, then it's really a matter of keep it simple, avoid the jargon, be respectful, but go back to your policy, because the policy gives you the guidance. It's not you as an individual saying, I think that your point of view is not right for what we do here in the library. You're saying, we've made certain rules about how we do things here that governs how we handle this. It's your ally in this. And also, use the resources that are available to help out. The Fund has created a broad variety of those. We've got a great booklet up here. If you want more of them, you can grab some at the end, called Raising a Reader, How Comics and Graphic Novels Can Help Your Kids Love to Read. This is designed for parents and professionals in the information sciences to show how to read a comic, what comics do that are good for learning, ways to use comics in the education space, activities you can do with your kids using comics, creativity activities you can do with your kids using comics. It's a really great tool. Just yesterday, we launched a new resource that we're going to be updating every week called the CBLDF Comics Connector. And this is a directory resource that matches creative professionals, writers, artists, editors, industry professionals in comics with local communities. So you can reach out to them and have them come in and give a talk in your school or in your library. It's absolutely free. It's cbldf.org/resources/comics connector. It's a great tool. We're going to be updating it every week. Right now, there's about 60 artists in a dozen American states and one Canadian province. But I suspect after this weekend, we're going to have a whole lot more here in Ontario that we can direct you to. We have a regular column called Using Graphic Novels in Education that highlights individual comics titles that right now span from juvenile up through high school and has discussion and teaching tools and techniques. We have discussion guides for all of our banned comics case studies. We have case studies that show when and how things were banned and how those challenges were overcome, which can be resources if you face a challenge to the same book or similar books. We have CBLDF Presents Manga, which is a resource about unpacking and using manga for collection, development, and defense. We have a couple copies left of Working with Libraries, a handbook for comics creators. This is designed for creators to reach out to libraries and find out how they can better work with you. It explains things like the library calendar and the cycle of life in a library, that explains things like why spines matter, why working with a publisher matters, why reviews matters, in a way that those in the profession might take for granted, but the artist who is developing their profession, who's really thinking about how to tell the story and find the audience, may not have thought about. So this is another tool with some good programming ideas in there. As well as cbldf.org, which is updated every single day with resources and stories about where censorship is happening around the world for comics and other kinds of books. Before I get into how we can help, though, we have some time. I'd like to invite some feedback about what your experiences are of book censorship or challenges or concerns that you might have about the subject area that come up in your day-to-day. Is there anybody out there that would like to share?
Uh-huh. Well, the biggest concern with mine is we actually, in my library room in Wilmington, we have a large collection of graphic novels that are for our foreign language collection. And because we split our collection in for foreign language still into adult and children, mm-hmm. The views over in Europe are a little bit different, and there's been a number of times where parents have issued concerns of these European comics and additional material, you know, nudity, sexual scenes, mm-hmm. when it's labeled for children. So, I mean, we do our best to address the concerns, and we've had to make some concessions of moving some to the adult collection. But
do you have a middle, like a young adult? Do you have juvenile, young adult, and adult, or do you just have juvenile and adult?
For the foreign language, we have juvenile and adult.
I see. And all of your comics are, how all of your comics processed? Would you repeat?
Yep, so it's generally for those, they are brought in our content processing, usually just Plagiarizer, if they're from the publisher. Mm-hmm. Like the juvenile, we show them in juvenile. Unfortunately, the content that people we have aren't as ingrained in the graphic novel knowledge as they should be.
Sure.
But they generally trust the publisher and the distributors to properly flag these.
Sure, well, you raised several good points. And the question was, for those of them back that didn't hear, that this gentleman's library has a foreign language section that uses foreign language graphic novels that either places them for juveniles or for adults. And there's a few issues at play here. One is that, of course, not every comic is right for every reader, and so it's very difficult to rely solely on the publisher guidance, particularly when you get into the second big point that I think you brought up here, cultural differences. In France, in cinema and in graphic novels and in kind of French-speaking, Belgian-speaking world, nudity is the equivalent of explosions in American cinema. And so it's not an offensive thing to depict an unclothed body in these environments. Japan is very similar. In the Dragon Ball series, which is frequently challenged, the character Goku is depicted running around naked. And this has been challenged as, why is this book that is flagged as appropriate for juvenile readers, which is actually written for younger readers, appropriate because there's a naked little boy running around here that's played for humor. And so cultural differences do enter into the equation in a fashion that isn't as binary as this book is appropriate for 7 to 12-year-olds or 7 to 9-year-olds or whatever the publisher rates it as. And Dragon Ball is a really great example of that. And there's no prescriptive answer to this. I think that the publishers are doing the best they can, but they need feedback from
folks like you at professional events like the American Library Association conferences and the conferences up here in Canada, their equivalent, saying, here are the specific issues that I'm having, how can you help out with this? And then there are also resources that groups like the Fund have created to help address these situations. We have 5 minutes. Are there other questions, comments out here? Down front.
Yeah, I just wondering if you had any thoughts on, I noticed, I think it was Tintin in the Congo, mm-hmm. was, and this is like, there's a real, in my mind at least, disconnect between, like, you know, you should have everything in the library, and then stuff that's going to be cataloged as children's stuff that maybe is dated in its view of, like might be racially offensive, like mm-hmm. Tintin in the Congo might be. Do you have any thoughts on that? Because clearly it's a kid's book, but it's also super dated.
Sure. The question was, are there thoughts about books that are dated that contain offensive content, such as Tintin in the Congo, which is using racial shorthand, racial cartoon shorthand that was socially acceptable when it was published in the first half of the 20th century that's no longer acceptable now. And this is that it's a living language and conversation. And so I do think it's problematic to ban that content. Personally, I understand that not all readers will want to access that content. And so having an active conversation about it with your patrons and creating more speech rather than less speech seems to be the best way to manage these things. Rather than trying to take away a work by Osamu Tezuka or by Hergé or by Will Eisner, who all use racial caricatures that were perfectly acceptable shorthand in the time of their creation, and saying that part of history doesn't matter anymore because it's unacceptable, or trying to take away Mark Twain, who uses the N-word frequently because it was used in that fashion at the time, creating a context around it for greater teaching tends to be a technique that is useful. I see a question over there. Yep?
I was just going to respond. You brought up Mark Twain. I think that's a good way to handle it.
Could you speak up a bit more? Because I know we can't hear you down here.
Sorry. You brought up Mark Twain, and that's a good response to it. I also think Warner Brothers, is it? That has like a lot of the early 30s and 40s cartoons, like Betty Boo and Classics, where you look at now, it's absolutely horrible. But their response was to put a little placard in front before the show starts that says, yes, we can do this.
Yeah, context. And as information professionals, I think it's important that we arm ourselves with the information. I know everybody's busy. I know not everybody has the time to engage with each book, you know, on an individual level. But when you are dealing with things that have legitimacy, either in the history of its art form or as story, being able to be knowledgeable of that context and reaching out for the resources that help out is useful. I'm going to make a quick point before we go to the break, and I'm going to stick around. If folks want to continue to ask questions during the coffee break that's going to start in 2 minutes, I'm happy to stick around for that. But briefly, I want to encourage you to celebrate Banned Books Week in the United States or Freedom to Read Week here in Canada. Banned Books Week is the annual celebration of the freedom to read that happens at the end of September each year. This year's theme is young adult books. Freedom to Read Week is observed in Canada at the end of February. You can learn more at freedomtoread.ca for that. Banned Books Week, you can learn more at bannedbooksweek.org. And here, I'll just leave on the screen for you to read while I take one last question from the floor, are some techniques that you can use to celebrate Banned Books Week or Freedom to Read Week. Do I have one more question down here before I let everybody go for the coffee break? Okay. Then I'm just going to briefly walk through there and then put some resources up. You can make a Banned Comics display. You can host a Banned Comics event using the Comics Connector to reach out to professionals in your community that can come in and give talks. You can distribute Banned Comics literature. And then finally, I'm going to put up this list of resources that you may want to take a look at for enhancing and continuing this conversation. Thank you for your time and attention this morning. I have some materials down here if you'd like to take some for your library. Have a great conference. Thank you.